Judgment Ice Radio for the Seeker.
Welcome to Red Ice Radio. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Henrik. You can hear us Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And every other Wednesday, you'll have Radio 314 with Lana. We feature interviews, investigations, and reports into cover-ups, hidden history, conspiracies, our forgotten past, and all kinds of controversial and essential topics that we consider to be vital to have some knowledge about. We are not only searching for answers, we are also searching for new questions to ask that will lead to new answers, things we do not yet know. You can follow us at redicecreations.com. Don't forget our busy news section, and you can subscribe to our RSS feeds for easy access. Also, check out our radio archive with all programs in their entirety on redicemembers.com. There you also have our TV episodes, videos, films, commentaries, and music as well. Today we have Tom Secker back on the program. He's a writer, researcher, and filmmaker who specializes in terrorism, the security services, and declassified history. He's been writing on the philosophy and politics of fear since 2008. His new book that we're going to talk about today is Secrets, Spies, and 7-7, focusing then specifically on the July 7th, 2005 bombings in London and other related historical cases of state-sponsored terrorism. All right, welcome back, Tom Secker. Good to talk with you again. Hope you've been good since we talked last time. What is it now? Maybe you recall that. I need to go into the archive and look. Probably a year and a half ago. Is it 2 years ago? No, can't be.
It's a while anyway. It's certainly over a year ago. Anyway, great to be back. Great to be back with you, Henry.
Oh yeah, definitely. Good to talk to you again. Hope everything have been good with you. And of course, you've been busy writing an excellent book, continuing of course with your websites, investigating the terror, and now of course the spyculture.com website. The book is called Secrets, Spies, and 7-7. Why don't we just begin talking a little bit about why you wanted to write this book, Tom?
Well, I've been involved in the whole 7-7 thing for several years now. And it was basically for the same reason I made my films. I made two films about the 7-7 case. The first came out in 2010, summer of 2010, called 7-7 Seeds of Deconstruction. And that was just a kind of, if you like, a review of what had been found out up until that point. What did we actually have in, 2009, 2010? To go on with that. And then we had these inquests in the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, which were a sort of legal procedure where they looked at the deaths of the 52 people who died in these bombings and tried to come to some determination about, for example, whether or not they could have been saved if the emergency services had got there quicker and looking at those sorts of questions. But they did also look at the question of what MI5 and the rest of the security services knew beforehand. And an awful lot of new information came out at those inquests. Most of it was, rather terribly covered in the mainstream media. And I'm rather disappointed to say quite a lot of it was ignored by the alternative media. So I made a second film, basically, is the upshot of that. I decided there's enough new information here that the previous questions that I looked at in the first film can be elaborated on. So I made a second film, 7-7 Crime and Prejudice. That came out in the autumn of 2011. And since then, I was looking at several other projects. And I did start several other projects, including this book that's now out. And I stuck with this one, I think, because it didn't exist, because there wasn't a really good up-to-date book on 7-7. There's plenty of good books on the other sorts of topics I was at that point thinking of writing about, but this one didn't exist. And just as with the films, I thought there's no point kind of sitting around whinging that something doesn't exist and that someone should be doing this when I could just do it myself. I mean, why not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the way to go about it.
That's why I did it, because I felt this is someone needed to create this. I've got the ability to create it. So I did.
Very good. Well, good for doing it, of course, because there's a lot of good information coming out of it and new stuff as well, as you said. Why is it, do you think, that the ball has been dropped? Well, we'll talk about it from both sides of the camp, of course, the mainstream media, and then we can get into the alternative as well. And as far as when I'm going through the book and reading this, obviously, I understand you want to try to get as close to an answer as possible, no matter where, you know, what side of fence it is, because you're both critical of the alternative theories that are coming out as well as the mainstream. So, but why is it that so few have, picked up on this, do you think?
I think it's partly because a lot of this is the hangover from 9/11, I feel, and that an awful lot of the people who started, who got involved with, if you like, the 7/7 truth movement, were people who were involved in 9/11 truth. But the two incidents were quite different, at least in the way that we experienced them and the way that the opportunity we had to investigate them. For example, on 9/11, some of the strongest evidence that, you know, the official story isn't true and that the real culprits were plain and simply someone else, most likely state actors, is that three buildings get blown up in New York. And an awful lot of people, even the first time they saw that on television live as it was happening, said, hang on, those buildings are being blown up. And obviously an awful lot of people then afterwards, when they had it shown to them and someone said, doesn't this look like it's being blown up to you? They said, actually, yeah, it really does. And of course, the official story is they weren't blown up. So that's all going on television. That's a relatively easy case to make, that you can make with, to be honest, 30 seconds of video. We don't have any of that for 7/7 because so much of the important stuff happened underground. It happened on underground trains. We didn't have the ease of being able to just go to some video and say, look, this clearly doesn't add up. And so the investigation, by its very nature, because of the difference in the events, we had to do something different with 7/7 to what we did with 9/11. Just the evidence that we had was different, the opportunity for investigation was different, and yet the people who were doing a lot of the alternative 7/7 investigations were trying to apply the same methods that they'd applied to 9/11 and got results with, when it just wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to work that way, I don't feel.
Right.
And meanwhile, of course, the number of people, the if you like, the cover-up in this country and the discouragement of to people away from investigating 7/7, I think has been more effective in this country than the cover-up of 9/11 was in the United States. For example, we had a 9/11 commission in the United States. It failed miserably at discovering anything but what they wanted it to find out. But at least it happened. At least that's on the record. And at least, you know, people could then, whatever, file freedom of information requests for all the FBI and CIA stuff that they were using.
Right.
So we could at least get all that. None of that happened in this country. We got one, you know, paltry 40, 50-page narrative report, which is just this sort of simpleton's account of what they say happened, with no real evidence, no sourcing, no footnoting, none of that stuff.
Right.
But because they had the mainstream media on side, and they just had a simple story and stuck to it and repeated it over and over and over and over and over, suicide bombers, suicide bombers, suicide bombers, lots of people believed that they were suicide bombers. And as a result, you have the number of people actually looking at this case being, I would say, far smaller than with 9/11. And their methodology was always likely to be very difficult to get any solid answers that way.
Yeah, it's a really good point. It reminds me a lot of the climate in Sweden as well, by the way. I mean, we're up in Northern Europe pretty much here, but it's that same kind of, you don't have the same level of investigations on in any capacity. It's very much that the official line that is being released has so much holes in it that it's just, you know, incredible, but yet despite that no one is doing it, and you know, it's just as you said that it's at those times that, you know, you need to do it yourself to get it done, and which is why this is even more important, you know, than ever. But just let's drag everyone with us in here if we can for a bit, Tom, as well. I think everyone who listens of course know about 7/7, knows some of the basic stuff there, but anyway, let's make sure everyone is with us. And maybe you can just give us a quick overview of what happened on 7/7. It's 8 years ago, by the way, to the day pretty much as we're doing this program now. So the 8-year anniversary if you can call it that, whatever it's called. It's actually coming up right now. So give us the outline, the basic outlines, and then we can run through all the details about this tome.
Okay, well, 7/7 simply was a series of bombings in London on the morning of July 7th, 2005. The official story is that four men joined up, came to London on trains, three of them split up at King's Cross Station, went on three trains heading away from King's Cross. These are tube trains, underground trains, and that they simultaneously, at about 10 to 9 in the morning, blew themselves up on these trains in suicide bombings. The other one, for no apparent reason, sort of hangs around for about another hour before getting on a bus and supposedly blows himself up on this bus in similar fashion. It officially killed 52 people and the four alleged bombers, and that has been entirely blamed on them. There has been no real kind of there's been lots of hints at a wider conspiracy, and there has even been a trial of three guys who had nothing to do with it. They were just friends with these four men. They were actually put through two trials and ultimately found not guilty, but essentially the official story is those four guys were to blame, and they were some sort of self-radicalized Muslim suicide bombers. That's pretty much it in simple terms. That's what we're talking about here. Yeah.
Yeah. Indeed. It's a very interesting situation, this one, because as you said, there's not much that, you know, visual availability. Of course, there's CCTV footage, and you've collected, you know, what's available on your websites. In the book, of course, you have outtakes of this as well. But what we know so far, what they claim, of course, is that we have four people involved in this, you know, Sadiq Khan, Tanweer, Lindsay, and Hussein. And then later I want to ask you about Demendez as well, by the way, the guy who actually got shot, which is, you know, a very strange scenario how that played out. But what do we know about these four, well, youth, really? They're teenagers, pretty much. They're you know, as usual, a lot of the terrorist bombers that, you know, I would say get you know, put the blame on in this case are usually very young guys, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Sadiq Khan was 30, but he was by some distance the oldest of the four, and he is de facto blamed as the sort of ringleader of this group. It's always assumed that he was the kind of the brains behind this and the real driving force behind the plot. Tanweer was only 22, Jermaine Lindsay was only 19, and I think Haseeb Hussain was only 18.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're talking about very young guys. What do we know about them? Well, three of them, Hussain, Tanweer, and Sadiq Khan, they were all from Leeds, which is in the north of England. I live quite near to Leeds. They were British-born Pakistanis. They grew up as sort of relatively conventional sort of Pakistani Muslim British household. Jermaine Lindsay was actually born in Jamaica, I think, but moved to England when he was about 2 years old. Grew up in England, supposedly converted to Islam some point in his teenage years. We don't know a huge amount about them that would indicate I mean, none of them had any history of violence. The only criminal record I know of with the four is that Sadiq Khan had some caution for assault back in 1993 or something, when he would have been about 18 years old. So this sounds like he got into a scuffle on the street when he was 18, you know, so what?
Right.
But none of them had any background as being known as being particularly religious, or had any background as violent criminals. There is nothing really there that would suggest, apart from the MI5 material, there's nothing really in their background that would say that they were suicide bombers, that they were radical Muslims, that they were intending, you know, mass murderers as well. All we really know is that they were, it seems, relatively ordinary guys. In fact, they seem, people have commented, you know, sort of how frighteningly normal they seem, but they are, of course, talking from the perspective of thinking that they're suicide bombers. To me, they're just normally normal, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Don't know. What else would you want to know about them?
Well, exactly. That's the thing. It's just they show up from you know, nowhere, pretty much, and then this happens. But, of course, as you said, there is background material to this, where they seem to have been, you know, deeper connections in other networks. But obviously the stance that we're taking here is that the official line is not true. The story has so many holes in it here. So we should just kind of dive into it right here, Tom, and just kind of explain a little bit about what you found out as you're looking into these people, the MI5 connection, and you know, as well, potentially what how they might have been dragged into this, if they're, you know, framed as patsies, or, you know, how we would go about explaining this to try to get closer to the truth, basically.
Well, sure. I mean, that's where I think most of the case really sits. I suppose taking it back as far as we really know, the main figure in this story is Mohammed Sadiq Khan himself. The other three are sort of involved in this story, but to a much, much lesser extent. But from early 2001, right up until 7/7 itself, Mohammed Sadiq Khan was involved in sort of borderline radical activity, nothing that would scream at you, this guy's potentially dangerous, this guy could possibly kill a bunch of people. But the sort of thing that MI5 have, and the Home Office and all the rest of the official story mongers have used to say, look, he had this sort of radical background. So what am I talking about? In January 2001, he attended a sort of training camp in the Lake District, here in the UK. I say training camp, basically they were doing quasi-military style exercises. They didn't have any weapons or any explosives. They weren't playing, you know, war games or anything like that. So we're talking pretty tame stuff. This camp was actually monitored by MI5 because it was being run by a gentleman called Martin McDade, who the security services had known about since 3 years earlier. They thought he was a possible radical, so they were following him around, and they monitored this training trip, this camping trip that he organized to the Lake District and several others. And among the people that they photographed was Sadiq Khan. Now, they say, oh, no, we didn't identify Khan from this image until after 7/7, so this wasn't in any way an intelligence failure or anything we could be blamed for. This was just, you know, something that we found in our records when we were going back over this. But there's a little bit more to it than that, because, among other things, it's not actually a photograph of Khan. It's a still from a bit of closed-circuit video recording. And this was a camera that MI5 had hidden in a barn near this camping trip. So there's lots of questions that come out of that among, you know,
sure,
among others. They say they only had this one image of Khan, and to be honest, when you look at that image, you think he's not particularly recognizable from it. I'm not surprised they didn't find out who he was. But if this is from a camera, then they must have had, you know, they must have had the full several seconds of him walking out
right
past this camera.
Yeah.
So did they show any of those other images to people? You know, we haven't seen any of these other images. We've just seen this one still picture.
Do we even know if it's available anywhere?
Well, presumably it would be locked somewhere in an MI5 building, but no one's ever asked for it. No one has ever sort of really tried to get hold of this.
That's amazing.
Because it's a security service thing. I mean, they just say no. Freedom of information doesn't apply to MI5, so to be honest, it would be kind of pointless asking them, really.
Right.
I don't mean to kind of sound defeatist, but you know, that's it, really. You're not going to get anywhere trying to get information out of them.
Right.
But by far the more important question is, how did they know where to hide the camera? They must have known about this trip. They must have known about where these people were going. They must have, to a certain extent, known about what they were doing. But instead, they've presented this just as, we had this one image of him from back in 2001, and just no one recognized it, and that's the end of the story. So it's hinting at they knew more, you know. Always, at every point in these kinds of things, it's always the hint. There's always these hints that they knew more than they're letting on. So from 2001 onwards, Khan was also involved in this Iqra bookshop. This is a sort of Islamic bookshop and learning center. It was just a little shop, really, up in Leeds, that was also being run by this guy, Martin McDade. It was a charitable organization of some sort, a sort of Islamic-themed charity, almost entirely funded by government grants, suspiciously enough. Mm. Khan and Tanweer were on the paperwork as trustees of this charitable organization. So they were quite involved in this thing. And again, MI5 knew about this. The security services were monitoring what was going on. In, I think it was April 2003, MI5 asked the local police special branch, the local police spies, to carry out some surveillance on this guy, Martin McDade. They follow him around for a few days, presumably trying to find out what he's up to and who he's connecting with and the normal things you would try and find out during surveillance. They see him get a lift in a BMW car that they check up on, and it turns out it belongs to this Sadiq Khan. They don't bother to tell MI5. They consider this information urgent enough that as soon as the surveillance is over, they go and check on the registration of this car, and their documents prove this. They checked immediately, and yet they thought at that point, oh, this is just trivial information. Now we've actually got a name. Let's not bother telling anyone. Let's not bother telling MI5, who've asked us to carry out this surveillance in the first place. That's their official story. I don't believe that for a moment. And to be honest, even the coroner at the inquests, who was sort of engaged in a massive cover-up from start to finish, even in her final report, she kind of casts a bit of doubt on whether or not they're telling the truth here, and that it doesn't really make sense that they didn't tell MI5.
Yeah.
Everyone really thinks they did tell them. So then there is, later in that year, later in 2003, there's another investigation into this Islamic bookshop. And they say they found out that it was a registered charity. They found out that it was run by Martin McDade and this other guy called Taf Mohammed. And basically they sort of found out what it was doing. They say they didn't find out that Khan and Tanweer were involved there. But this is balmy, because the only way they could have really found out it was a registered charity is by getting the paperwork from the Charities Commission, the people you have to register with to be a registered charity. And the paperwork from the Charities Commission quite clearly has Sadiq Khan and Shehzad Tanweer's names on it as trustees. And again, I include all this documentation in the book, both in the ebook version and the paperback. You get all this. They say they never looked at it. They say they never looked at this paperwork, and so therefore they couldn't have found out that Khan and Tanweer were involved there. But they must have done, otherwise they couldn't have found out this other information that they had. So you have this pattern with this Martin McDade, Sadiq Khan connection, which is that at every point that Khan gets involved in any of this, the sort of training camps, this radical bookshop, whatever, he's getting involved through McDade. McDade is his point of contact. He is the guy who's actually running all of this. At every point, MI5 and the other security services have information on this. They have an investigation running into McDade and what he's up to, and they find out all sorts of information. Yet, mysteriously, they always stop short of arresting McDade. McDade himself was never arrested, even after 7/7, when he was in the newspapers talking about this.
Right.
He wasn't arrested and questioned about his connection with these guys. And they never stop Sadiq Khan either. And they've tried to present this as a story of, oh, well, it was maybe a missed opportunity here or there, and maybe we could have stopped these guys from doing it. But if we start from the premise that these guys didn't do it, which seems likely, what might it look like? It looks more like these so-called intelligence failures were deliberate. They were some kind of, you know, information was being compartmentalized, and investigations were sort of being stopped as soon as they got to a certain point and weren't allowed to go any further. And that ultimately this seems to have been about obscuring and covering up Khan's connection with McDade. So I wonder, is McDade a spy? Was McDade an agent provocateur working for the British Security Services?
Right.
Because otherwise, how does he get away with sort of being monitored for all these years in all these different ways? And given the sheer number of people that they've arrested as part of this whole war on terror thing, you would have thought he would have at least been arrested at some point, but he wasn't. It was like hands off.
He's protected.
And that suggests, yeah, exactly. And that suggests to me that he's some kind of agent.
And have you come any closer to finding out more about him and if this is true?
Well, it's very difficult to, because he's disappeared now.
No one knows where he is.
No one seems to know where he is. Even the BBC haven't been able to track him down. And they seem to have genuinely tried, at least to some extent, to track him down, but never managed to get anywhere. The last he was heard of was teaching English in some college in Soha, which I think is in Oman, you know, miles away. There is some weird website supposedly set up by ex-students of his at this college, accusing him of being an Islamic radical and of being a sort of, you know, rather unpleasant human being. It's a strange website. I've got no idea how authentic it is or where this has really come from. But that's sort of all we're left with. And all of that kind of, again, it hints at, you know, this guy's a spook. He's gone off somewhere to be something else. Maybe his name wasn't even Martin McDade. His real name, I mean. So trying to track him down now. However amazing it would be if we could actually get our hands on this guy and ask him, I don't think it's very likely to happen.
It's not going to happen. Now, of course, the it's very interesting that these people are protected in this regard, and that the defense, if you will, that is there in place, the intelligence that is there in place that are meant to catch these things, if you will, is convenient at these positions and these points, kind of just dropped off pretty much, and it doesn't go any further from that. And I think one of the things that you do well as well in the book, Tom, is that you bring up other historical examples of this similar type of behavior, not only of course with all the spy networks and the double agents and everything, and the sting operations. This just goes on and on. And I think we have to be able to get into this mindset to understand what happened during 7/7, and also of course what the motives might be, what the reasons might be that we'll get into later. But some of the historical examples are incredibly important so people can understand that it's happened in the past, and it's not something new. It's not something that just started in the 2000s with all these, you know, recent incarnations. So why don't we talk about some of the historical examples? And the UK alone, of course, with MI5 and everything, has a very interesting history of terrorists, of, you know, the first suicide bombers and all this stuff. There's a lot of stuff here.
Well, sure. I mean, I take it all the way back to the sort of 1880s and 1890s, partly because the sort of terrorists of the day, or so-called terrorists of the day, I mean, I suppose some of them were actually terrorists, were anarchists. They were people who were part of the sort of radical side of the labor movement to some extent, and just generally people who were resisting this mass industrialization and saw that industrialization was becoming a kind of centralizing state philosophy. And they were opposed to all of that. And obviously I have a lot of sympathy with that. They're my kind of people. So I'm interested in the history of them. And I'm interested in what they got up to and what was done to them. And when you look into, in particular, what was going on in Britain, but this was going on in the United States at the same kind of time, and it was going on across Europe and into Russia, basically everywhere where you had a anarchist movement at the end of the 19th century, you had the local regional security services infiltrating them and provoking them and trying to entrap them and all the rest of it. So a couple of cases that are particularly important. One was the Walsall anarchists in 1892, a group of young men, just like, you know, just the same sort of thing that's going on with 7/7, some of the cases around that.
Yep.
Basically, a bunch of young men were targeted by an agent provocateur called Auguste Coulon, who was working for Special Branch. This is before the days of MI5. And he infiltrated this group. He wrote them letters containing diagrams that for how to build bombs. The police even fabricated some like bombshell cases and entered them into the trial after they'd arrested these guys and put them on trial. They entered these bomb cases that they'd made as exhibits, as evidence against these men, as though the men had made them. It gets to the trial. The defendants, or at least some of the defendants, start asking questions about this other guy, Coulon, and saying, well, why wasn't he arrested? Why isn't he up on trial with us? Was he working for Special Branch? Was he working for the police? The police detective basically refused to answer these questions, and the judge rules in his favor. And so Coulon is sort of, you know, written out of the story. These guys get sent down for up to 10 years hard labor and blamed as terrorists. And the whole thing is sort of used to kind of amplify this perception of a terrorist threat from the anarchist movement and from the labor movement in general. Then a couple of years down the line, there is this incident in Greenwich Park in East London, near the Royal Greenwich Observatory, where a man called Marshal Bourdin, a young French anarchist, accidentally, it seems, blew himself up. He was carrying a bomb. Some suspect he was trying to bomb the Royal Observatory. He may have just been trying to sort of stick a bomb somewhere and run off. And he was sort of on his way up the hill towards this observatory. He seems to have tripped over, accidentally set the bomb off, blown a big hole in his stomach and blown one of his hands off. he can't say anything about this. He's still alive for about another half an hour or something, but he doesn't say anything about it. He's obviously in sort of a tremendous state of shock. No one really knows why this happened, but what happens in the aftermath is two different special branch detectives published memoirs in British newspapers. I have copies of the full memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
Basically propounding different conspiracy theories as to what Marshall Bourdain was doing and how he came to die in Greenwich Park.
Right.
I should say, the inquest into Bourdain's death officially ruled that it was a suicide. Even though there's no real evidence of this, the guy had like gold coins in his pockets. He was clearly on his way somewhere after this bombing. He intended to live. So why they concluded that it was a suicide, I don't know. But again, it's just like with 7-7. With no real evidence that these guys actually deliberately killed themselves, they just concluded it was suicide.
Yep.
They were suicide bombers. Case closed. And so the parallels between these two kind of, they strike me as being very important, and that's why I included them in the book. But yeah, there's two different sort of theories about what Bourdain was up to, according to these special branch detectives. One is that he was trying to deliver the bomb to some other anarchists who were going to take it overseas and use it there, and that something went wrong in the delivery and he accidentally blew himself up. The other theory is that Bourdain himself had been accused of being a spy, being an undercover agent, and had set out to carry out a bombing to kind of prove his credentials and prove that he was a bona fide anarchist, and that, again, something had gone wrong and he'd ended up blowing himself up. There is another possibility, and that is the fact that his brother-in-law was a guy called Henry Samuels, who was definitively a spy for Special Branch. And it is suggested in a novel by Joseph Conrad in 1907, a novel called The Secret Agent, where he kind of retells this story. It is suggested that Bourdain was actually set up by his Special Branch brother-in-law, or his spy brother-in-law, and that this was some kind of state-generated, state-provoked attack.
Right.
And that it was, you know, a false flag event. And so all of this is going on 100 years before 7-7 happened.
It's amazing. For such a long time. That's the thing as well. That's why it's so important to go back, just as you do. I mean, and just point out this aspect alone, that intelligence agencies use groups, in some cases they even set them up, of course, but infiltrate them early on in the process, or get, you know, some of your folks in there, anarchists that they use. You know, this is true also for far left and far right groups, as we've seen. They infiltrate them and then use them in different settings to of course put the blame on them. And it's a very old tactic to do this, and the latest incarnation of this that we're seeing, Tom, is with Al Qaeda, how they're being funded and supported, and yet at the same time, demonized, if you will, as a strategy of radicalization, pretty much.
Yeah, absolutely, and the same thing happened. You know, same thing happened in most of Western Europe and a lot of other bits of Europe and other parts of the world under Operation Gladio.
Yes.
That is pretty well known. I think the local British equivalent of Gladio was actually the war in Northern Ireland, because there again, you have a genuine radical movement. You have republicanism, people who want to be independent of British government and have a single Republic of Ireland, that was infiltrated, manipulated, provoked, to some extent funded, trained, by the British security state, and their point there seemed to be to direct these people towards violence so that they would carry out atrocities and people would then turn against them and say, oh, no, these Republicans, they're dangerous, they're horrible, they're terrorists. We can't enter into a political process with them and actually look at their political demands seriously. On the other side, you have the loyalists, the people who are still loyal to the British, who also had their militant strand, who was fighting the militant strand of the Republican movement. And again, it was infiltrated by British security services, and there the point seemed to be to use these militants as a proxy force, so they would actually carry out assassinations against Republican targets who the British considered enemies of the state. They would use these radicals to do that.
Yeah.
So both sides of that conflict are heavily infiltrated by all different branches of British security services. To some extent, I think at times they were even fighting each other. You actually have sort of MI6 and MI5 operations pulling this thing in a different direction. So no wonder it ended up a complete mess. But it was a strategy of tension. It was, pitch these sides against each other, inflame the whole situation, add tension, add polarization, get everyone sort of frightened and scared and thinking that it's all really extreme and it's all getting out of control and it's all crazy. When in fact, it's actually quite straightforward. And none of this needed to happen. None of this violence needed to happen. And we could have just had a political negotiation and solved the problem. But that is, of course, the last thing that they actually want to happen is peaceful negotiations solving a problem.
Yeah.
They don't want us to believe that that's possible. They want us to believe that it's all about, oh, we've got to go and fight the terrorists and we've got to lock them up and we've got to kill them and we've got to drone bomb them and all of that kind of thing. Because if you say, actually, we could solve this with peaceful negotiation, you don't need any of that. And the military-industrial complex is just over.
That's right. Exactly. And here we get into the incentive of why this is being done. And this, is, of course, is not a threshold for people to get over and realize. I mean, again, most people listening to this program won't be at that position. But what a lot of people are, fighting with, if you will, is this realization that the need for terrorism is great in society as it exists right now and structured with all the, as you said, the military-industrial complex and all the parties involved in making money on war, but also at the same time managed to basically reform society, reform countries, reform their security policies, etc., with the aid of this constant threat being, looming right behind us all the time. So this is very beneficial, and many people don't understand this. That's kind of outside, if you will, of this the circle that we're talking about right now, Tom.
Yeah, I feel a lot of people don't understand it. You're right. But this is, again, partly why I wrote the book, is because I was trying to say, by using these historical parallels and examples, that, this isn't, as you say, this isn't a new thing. But particularly in Britain, we've pretty much always had a war on terror of some kind going on, apart from the period when we were involved in the two world wars, when we didn't really have time for terrorists. apart from that, since about 1880 to the present day, we have been involved in a constant so-called war on terror of some kind.
Wow.
Obviously, it goes from one enemy to the next, to the next, to the next, depending on what actually is going on in the world. But so, as a result, I mean, one thing I should say is the guy who was running Auguste Goulon, who infiltrated the Walsall anarchists, and who was also running Henry Samuels, Marshal Bourdin's brother-in-law, was a guy called William Melville. Now, he became the first head of the Secret Service Bureau, which is the original incarnation of MI5. And he actually trained most of the first generation of MI5 officers in this country in the sort of 1900s, 1910s, 1920s. The guy who was doing all of this, or at least most implicated in doing all of this back in the 1890s, was the guy who laid the very foundations of the institution that we now have that's supposedly trying to keep us safe. And so it's no coincidence and it's no surprise that these same methods would be carrying on now. This is their bread and butter. This is where they came from. This is what they actually do for a living. I know they like to tell us that it's all about national security and it's all about protecting the public, but they couldn't give a damn about protecting the public. That much is obvious. Just when you start peeling it back and kind of tracing back, okay, where have these ideas come from and who are these sort of significant figures in this history? It adds up. You find solid material, solid evidence that there is a culture, particularly within the British security state, but I would say within every security state, of generating violence, of provoking it, of allowing it to happen, of sometimes just flat out making it happen.
Yeah.
In order to scare people, in order to create that, that dynamic that we spoke about before with the Breivik thing. It's the same dynamic of,
that's right,
violence, therefore fear, therefore there's a need for security.
Yeah.
It's not really any more complex than that.
Yeah, it's true. It's very simple. It's out there in the open. You bring it up in the book as well, of course, but the Force Research Unit, the FRU, is another one of these organizations that was that's part of the in Northern Ireland, basically, that people can look into. And it just like Gladio, it's more or less kind of out in the open of what's going on there. But yet at this time, there's some kind of disconnection when it comes to in modern times, Tom, just because, I mean, the same strategy is there, the same kind of method is there. But as you said, it's shifted now from, over to a Middle Eastern terrorism or Al-Qaeda or Arabs or Muslims, what have you. It's shifted over there. And therefore, it's yet another threshold, another level for people to understand and come into this realization that now they're using a different group, So the question, as we go back to, is, are there in your view, Tom, as you've been looking into this, are there any real terrorists out there at all at this stage?
It would depend on quite how you would define terrorist. It is one of those terms that's almost exclusively used in a really sort of partial and subjective way.
That's right.
But are there people willing out there willing to commit violence for political or religious ends? Yeah, of course there are. But there always have been and there always will be. And for other ends, for that matter. It's just those two are probably the most common. I don't think there was ever really an organized Al-Qaeda gang of any in the sort of militarized gang sense that we've been presented it as. There was an Al-Qaeda gang around bin Laden and Zawahiri, but I don't know, at least 30 to 40% of the people involved in that have some kind of connection to the security services. And those people were all the people, they were senior people. There were people like Ali Mohammed, who was Al-Qaeda's main trainer for about a decade. He was the guy who trained everyone who did the World Trade Center bombing and most of the people who did the embassy bombings. And this guy's doing all this simultaneously. It seems he's working for the CIA. And he certainly was in the US Special Forces for a while and briefly was an FBI informant. So people like that, you look at this whole Al-Qaeda thing and you think it's some kind of pseudo-gang. It's a gang. It is real in as much as these people do actually exist and are, to some extent, doing the things that they're being blamed for. But it's all because of a manipulation. It's that at each key node, each sort of key point in these stories, in these plots, in whatever, you find agents. You find people who are working for the Pentagon or MI6 or MI5 or someone. And again, going back to 7-7, it's the same thing. We talked about McDade, but the other side of this is these two other fellas called Mohammed Qayyum Khan, known as Q, and Junaid Babar. From around March 2003 until March 2004, there was this massive intelligence operation in Britain, intelligence counterterrorism operation called Operation Crevice. And it was based around this guy, Mohammed Qayyum Khan, known as Q. He is supposedly an Al-Qaeda facilitator in the UK, and they start investigating him, and from him they get onto this network of supposed Islamic radicals who were planning to build a great big fertilizer bomb and blow it up. They arrested all of these people at the end of March 2004, but they didn't arrest Q. Even the BBC cottoned onto this and started asking, well, was this because Q was working for the security services? Was he some kind of informant for them? And is that, in fact, what Operation Crevice was? It wasn't that they started investigating him and found all these other people. It's that he started telling them about all these other people, and therefore they got an investigation out of it. I would actually go one further. I'd say it was the whole thing was an entrapment operation, and that Q was very much likely working for the security services. And you get the same story with him as you get with McDade. Repeated investigations that mysteriously stop whenever they seem to come across anything significant. There's always intelligence failures. And in particular, whenever Q connects up with Sadiq Khan, and they did have phone calls and what have you between them, and they did meet several times, it seems that they tried to leave no trace of that. It seemed that these so-called intelligence failures obscured Khan's connection with Q. Now, this is all going on in the UK. On the other side of the world, you have this American guy called Junaid Babar, who is running a terrorism training camp in Pakistan, outside a town called Malakand. And several of this so-called fertilizer bomb plot group in the UK, along with Sadiq Khan and some others, were sent over there in the middle of 2003 to supposedly get training at this Malakand camp. Apparently they're all sent there by Q. So again, why isn't Q being arrested and asked about this?
Right.
Why are these guys ending up in prison and on terrorism charges? And this guy's just disappeared again, you know. Babar is a very interesting character. He was born in Pakistan, but he grew up in the United States, in Queens, in New York. He joined Al-Muhajirun, which is this sort of notoriously infiltrated Islamic organization, joins Al-Muhajirun in New York in sometime in the year 2000. In 2001, when 9/11 happens, his mother was actually in the World Trade Center. She worked in the World Trade Center as a cleaner, so she was nearly killed in the attacks. And You might think Babar would be a bit annoyed about this, but instead he decides to join Al-Qaeda. yeah, makes sense of that one.
Yeah.
he flies off to Pakistan, doesn't return to the United States for about another 3 years, and he runs this Malakand training camp. Virtually everyone who passes through this training camp ends up in court on terrorism charges, with Babar testifying against them, because when he goes back to the US, which is just about the time that the whole of Operation Crevice is winding up and they're getting ready to arrest all of these people, he goes back there, and a couple of weeks later, the FBI approach him outside his house, ask him to be a cooperator, and he instantly, without any hesitation, says yes, and gives up the whole thing, tells them absolutely everything that he'd been up to. And so the implication is, of course, that Babar was not just someone who turned into a cooperator, but was actually, again, some sort of agent provocateur or entrapment agent or something, working for the security services the whole time he was in Pakistan. And there's even a quote from a guy within the FBI, the head of the National Security Division of the FBI, told the BBC in a documentary. He described Babar as being crucial or critical, and he said he had the access, he had the means to get into all of these groups that just wouldn't have existed without him. Well, if Babar was arrested in early April 2004, and from then on, for the next 4.5 years, he's either in hotel rooms spilling his guts to the FBI, or he's in jail, how does he have access to any terrorist groups?
Right.
How does he grant them any access? The only way he has access is if he was a spy beforehand, before all that happens. That's the only way that comment from a very senior FBI guy makes any sense. So, yeah, just that's the pattern. At every point that Khan gets involved in any of this, the bookshop, the training camp in Pakistan, this getting involved with this fertilizer bomb plot gang in the UK, he's doing it through one of these three men, and all three men appear to be working for the security services. And every single time, MI5 or whoever have information on this, seemingly do nothing with it, and manage to cover up his connections with these probable secret agents. And all of that just says to me, just shouts at me, this is some kind of black operation. This is some kind of spy game.
And in many cases, it's also, well, I've struggled a little bit with this for some time, because it's, you know, when you begin to investigate certain things, you know, you discover how early on in the process, how many contradictions there are, how the reporting that you hear, that you pick up on, is there's so many holes in it that it's, I mean, on the first level, that feeds the conspiracies around it right away, because it's, you know, it's not consistent. But then at the same time, as you get into it even more, you think, all right, so what game is really being played here, and at how many levels do the operation run on? And in some cases, Tom, it almost seems to me that some of the people involved does not even seem to realize exactly what's going on. I mean, in certain cases, there are patsies. I mean, again, we can go back to the example maybe of Sadiq Khan, Tanweer, Lindsay, and Hussein here, and speculate then that, okay, they're patsies. But what level are they aware of that they potentially are part of an exercise, let's say, that they willingly have gone along with to be part of? Or is it that they just happen to be on this place at this time, and the security, you know, the conclusions that we're fed in the official media is in that regard just a straight out lie, because they happen to be part, they happen to be on these trains at these times, so let's just put the blame on them, kind of thing. But it seems there are double agents, there are triple agents, and in certain regards, it doesn't seem that the people involved themselves don't know which side they're working for, if you're getting my point here, Tom. I might complicate things a bit, but what do you make of it? How would you explain some of these immense contradictions and misunderstandings with all of this?
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking, sort of thinking around what you just said. Okay, one of the problems is there isn't much evidence that they were ever actually on those vehicles at the times of the explosions. I mean, their bodies weren't found there, at least in Khan and Tanweer's case, until 2 days later.
Yeah.
So, and there's no CCTV, obviously. There's no CCTV of these guys within 20 minutes of these targeted trains and this targeted bus. So there's a lot of space in between where we can get them up to in their journey and where they officially ended up. There's a pretty big gap there, and that gap may be filled by many different things. So I don't think it's a case of they just sort of plucked them, they found them, found that they'd been on these trains and this bus, and therefore decided to blame them.
Right.
I think there must have been a pretty considerable a forethought and foreplan to blame these four men. I've never really bought this notion that they were taking part in an exercise or thought they were taking part in an exercise. I think it's much more likely that Sadiq Khan himself may have been recruited by the security services, because just as we might say these intelligence failures, so-called intelligence failures, allowed Junaid Babar, Martin McDade, Q to continue with whatever they were doing and to sort of get away with whatever they were doing, we could apply the same with Sadiq Khan. They did have a lot of information on Khan. They connected several cars to him, several mobile phones, several addresses, various people. They had a lot on this guy, and yet they never really seemed to do anything about it. So I do wonder, and I'm not the only person who's raised this possibility, was Sadiq Khan working for the security services? And if so, was he then double-crossed in some way? And is that what we're looking at on the morning of 7-7, right, that he thought he was doing something as part of some, you know, some spook has told him to do this, and that, yeah, they were setting them up? I think that sort of scenario is considerably more likely. As to who knew what, well,
that's impossible to know.
Or it'd be impossible to know without getting at least these three men up on a witness stand,
yeah,
and say, you know, what did they actually say to you? What did you actually think you were doing? And what were you, as far as you were concerned, what were you trying to accomplish by doing whatever you were doing?
Yeah.
And chances of that happening are very, very slim. I will say this: one of the telltale signs for me is when I made a kind of link chart, you know, like an Able Danger style link chart, sure, of all of these different people.
Mm-hmm.
Partly just to test out the software that I had, but also to sort of just develop this a bit and try and, you know, give myself a visual aid so that I could look back and think, right, who is connected to who at what point and who did know what at what point about whom. And one thing that struck me is that these three men, McDade, Junaid Babar, and Q, I don't think any of them ever met. They were all involved. They all connect through Sadiq Khan and through various other people on this chart. But I don't think any of those three men ever actually met face to face, as though their handlers were keeping them apart. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you asked me that question. Did they know what they were up to? I don't think. I think Junaid Babar, I think he probably knew that he was on some kind of mission to set people up and that he was going to end up as a witness in court testifying against these people. I think he knew that much. I don't think he knew that Sadiq Khan was going to end up as a patsy suicide bomber, alleged suicide bomber, and that guy was going to end up dead and that he was going to sort of vaguely play into the background of these so-called intelligence failures. I don't think he knew that part of it, because, to be honest, why would they have told him?
Exactly.
You know, all they need him to do is go to Pakistan and run this camp and, you know, get people off the airplane when they turn up, take them through the camp, send them home again, and then 2 years later he's in court testifying against them. That's all he really probably knows about.
Mm.
It's neat to know, you know.
Well, exactly. And also then it's pretty extraordinary that, you know, despite the level of involvement, they are sold out and sacrificed by the intelligence agencies to be able to pull this plot off. They're, you know, that's pretty rough stuff, you know?
Well, they do turn on their own assets quite a lot, as we've seen, not just with whistleblowers, and I mean authentic whistleblowers, rather than, you know, this recent fashion for somewhat more dodgy whistleblowers that we seem to have got ourselves.
Yeah, that's right.
But, you know, when you see real intelligence agency whistleblowers, people who actually turn around against these institutions and say, I have a moral objection to what you asked me to do, to what you employed me to do, they treat them terribly. They really do. They seem to have absolutely no sense of loyalty whatsoever towards these people, let alone any sense of responsibility and, oh, you know, maybe we should actually look at what we did here and, you know, actually change some stuff. They would never do that. But even just the way they treat the individuals, I think it indicates a pretty nasty moral and personal culture at the heart of these institutions. And so it doesn't surprise me that much when, I mean, it took me a long time to map all this out with these people and, you know, to go through all the documentation and take the timeline that they'd officially given us and then take the timeline of what the evidence actually said and compare the two and figure out, okay, how are they lying to us and therefore why are they lying to us?
Mm.
To do that took a long time. And part of the reason for doing that was because, you know, I thought no one else is going to do it. And these institutions, I think there is something seriously rotten within them, and that has to be confronted. But also, as a result, when I did find what I found and what I put into the book, it didn't surprise me a huge amount. And I don't mean that in a sort of moral sense. I am pretty angry and pretty disgusted by what I think has happened here. But if I was surprised by it, then, you know, I'd be distracted myself. That surprise would get in the way of me being able to think about this rationally and try and confront this rationally. Anyway, that's kind of how my take on it, my approach.
Definitely really good, Tom. And also, I just wanted to put that in there that, of course, you're talking about whistleblowers or those who speak out against what's going on inside. But also, my point was even that even the loyal agents, if you will, of these agencies are sold out and sacrificed. They don't even have to be in a position where they object in any regard. They're like, they're part of a plan, of a drill. They're in there and doing it and whatever. But then later they're, you know, kind of sold out. It's kind of similar to what seems to have been going on in terms of the Boston bombings and stuff like that as well. There's another scenario where there's contact with intelligence agencies that might potentially, I mean, that's not 100% clear yet, but they might have been, you know, on the payroll in one regard or another, but they're sacrificed. They're sold out for the you know, bigger purpose here of what we're talking about.
Well, yeah, certainly. And I think we might disagree about which particular intelligence service was sort of running around in the background of the Tsarnaev brothers. But yeah, they do have that feel to them, particularly the older one seems to be someone who was on some kind of intelligence mission for, we're not sure quite who or which side yet, but that he was in that way positioned to take the fall for this thing, whether or not he actually went there with a rucksack and planted a bomb, or whether he even knew that that rucksack contained a bomb, or any of these
That's right.
We're still not certain with that one. But yeah, I'd point to people to the example also of the Watergate burglars, who are all former CIA clandestine operations. None of them were objecting or whistleblowing, like you say. They were actually on a mission for the sort of White House's private CIA unit, you know, the plumbers. And they were sold out completely, you know.
That's right.
They stuck it all on them and Nixon walks away free.
Unbelievable.
There's it's all part of this same culture, and it is a culture of fundamentally sort of moral corruption and complete willingness to betray human beings.
Yeah, and follow orders, you know, without thinking what they're part of in that regard. And therefore, I mean, it might be really harsh, but in that regard, I do not feel pity for a lot of these people in terms of the work that they're involved in and doing. It of course doesn't make the world a better place, because we're continually moving down the aisle of you know, terrorism being the new global, you know, war pretty much here. But the question is, you know, why do you think that people that are involved in these projects and drills and everything else are involved in it, or that they go along with it, and who are involved, that they're willingly doing it? As you say, though, Tom, that in some cases it might be that actually they're on a need-to-know basis. They actually don't know what the bigger plan is. But again, there seems to be a certain willingness to go, you know, so far to get it achieved. Do you think they're ideologically convinced that this is the right thing to do, or is there anything else behind that? What do you think?
I think it probably depends from person to person. Some of them, I think, are sort of in awe of the intelligence services, sort of in their thrall. They, you know, see them as these great big powerful things that they want to be part of, and therefore they'll do anything necessary to be part of it. The same way a young person might look at a street gang. You know, a young lad might look at this gang and see, oh, you know, they'll give me, you know, I'll be part of something powerful, I'll have some identity, I'll, you know, these are all things that, of course, why wouldn't you want those things? But then they start to think, oh, well, what do I have to do to get those things? And they tell you, right, well, you've got to shoot some rival gang members. Some of those kids are going to go and do it.
Yeah.
Is it really that different in a terrorist gang or anything else? I don't think it is. Then you've got the people who I think are ideologically motivated. I think some of these people are actually genuine radicals who think that they're advancing their radical cause by getting into bed with their putative nominal enemy. But that's been going on for such a long time. And sometimes it's worked. I mean, let's face it, some people have taken money off the CIA and then turned around and burned them with it. So
quite a risk to take, though. For you.
Most of them have ended up dead. But, that's right. But, you know,
what a lottery.
That is the world that they chose, kind of thing. Yeah. And other ones, I think, some of them, I think, are just sort of horrendous, horrible, sociopathic individuals.
Well,
I certainly
there you go.
Think, I certainly think, for example, not to get into all the detail because we're coming up against the end of the first hour, but David Headley, for example, the mastermind behind the Mumbai thing, I think he was basically a sociopath, and that the CIA got their hooks into him and told him what he had to hear in order to do the things they wanted him to do. So I think it depends. Let's face it, these people have an awful lot of information. They can find out a lot of information about the people they're targeting as agents. Therefore, they can find out how to push their buttons and get them to do the things they want them to do, whatever those buttons are and however you have to push them in order to get them to do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what intelligence work and running agents is ultimately all about.
Yeah, that's right. It's a shocking realization, of course, when you realize what really is going on and the strategy that they use. But it does make sense when you begin to piece it together. And just as you say, on the most mundane level of it, that these agencies and ultimately the individuals within these agencies are interested in perpetuating, the task that they've been given, just like any business, really. and it's really, harsh and difficult to say that, but that's just the case. But then, as you say, Tom, on top of that, you might have a ideological, driven person, or even a psychopath or mentally ill people that seem to rise to the top within these agencies and basically take it over in a certain regard, hijack it, and now, look at the mess we're in.
Well, I mean, all I was really trying, I'm sure there are other motives and I'm sure there are other dynamics that we could come up with if we sort of analyzed this a bit further and thought a bit longer. Those are just the examples that kind of fly into my head from the people that I've looked at and the specific sort of plots and things that I've looked at.
Yeah.
But yeah, just like I say, this is what they do for a living. This is what the intelligence services do. They find people who they can get to do the things they want them to do, and they find out enough about them that they can prod them and poke them in the right way and entice them in the right way to get them to do those things. That's exactly what they spend most of their time doing. So I'm sure by now, several centuries into this relatively permanent security state that we now have, I'm pretty sure they've got quite good at it.
It's another good example of how government are keeping us all safe. Anyway, why don't we take a short break here, Tom, and talk a little bit about the websites first, of course, and give out the details of where people can pick up a copy of the book. It's called Secrets, Spies, and 7-7. And give us the website. You set up one specifically for the book as well, Tom. So give out the URL and how people can pick up a copy for reading more of this, of course. We've hardly even scraped the surface of all the details that you do go into in the book, and we'll try to get more into that in the second here, but give us the details first, Tom.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can get the ebook version, the electronic version of the book at all the usual places: iTunes, Amazon, wherever, Barnes and Noble, all the rest of it. If you want the paperback, it's only available via my investigatingtheterror.com website. I do have adverts on both my main websites. That's investigatingtheterror.com, which is obviously all about the intelligence agency's relationship with terrorist gangs. And I also have a relatively new website called spyculture.com. There's also an advert on that, on the front page of that site, that'll take you to where you can buy the book. Spyculture.com is all about the intelligence agency's relationship with the culture industries, which is, it gets into all of the predictive programming thing and, seeding of notions about the security services and about spies. And we'll get all into all that in the next section. But yeah. If you want the paperback copy, go to investigatingtheterror.com or spyculture.com, and you'll just see a thing on the homepage that you click on. That'll take you to the order page. And that order page also has the links to all of the places where you can get the ebook. And it also has a link to a page where I've uploaded all of the documentation, the MI5 documents and the CCTV and all the rest of it, the source material, the key source material that I used in the book. So you can access all of that completely for free, of course. Download it, watch it, whatever. So you can see, where it is that I got my information from.
Very good. Excellent, Tom. All right, Secret Spies and 7-7. Get a copy of the book, of course, if you want to read more about this and really dig into the sources of how Tom has pieced this together, of course, in the website investigatingtheterror.com and spyculture.com. We'll have these up on our website, so you can click through easily from there. All right, but we'll take a short break here. We'll be right back in a little bit. So stay with us, everyone. More in the second coming up.